Michael Hilliard is a geopolitical analyst, host, and creator of the Red Line podcast. Together, Michael and his team take a deep, deep fortnightly dive into an eclectic mix of different narrow geopolitical topics. And so clearly for listening to this, you're into geopolitics, I could not recommend more highly that you add the Red Line to your geopolitical new podcast feed. A link is, of course, in the description. And this is Michael's second appearance on the pod. His first appearance, he hinted at a time in his life when he was living in Kazakhstan, ghostwriting geopolitical analyst, and that has just stuck with me ever since. And so in this pod, we do Michael. I cut it off at around an hour mark, just before Michael goes into the geopolitical significance for Australia of Indonesia. But before then, we get his tidbits on Turkmenistan, why it has a lower freedom index in North Korea, Michael's own personal journey from touring as a bass player to rock and roll journalism into the world of geopolitical ghostwriting. And so this was a really special episode for me. Huge fan of Michael and the Red Line and everything he does. And so you'll hear a call to action after to go to a Curious Worldview podcast to listen to the rest of this show, because as I've said every week, but take a risk alongside me. Let's assume we have more interests in common. Go to a Curious Worldview, and hopefully you will not be disappointed. And here is Michael Hilliard.
So I first spoke to you a couple of years ago. I was a huge fan of the pod. I mean, still a huge fan of the pod. And we spoke for a while, and you sort of teased out these details from your past as a ghostwriter and the journalism. And I found it all so interesting. But before we get up to that serendipitous experience in Russia that pulled you in this direction, tell me just more about yourself before that. You know, what were you like as a kid? Where are you from? Did you ever have these sort of geopolitical dreams, etc.?
It's very odd for me to chat about myself. It's quite rare. So as a kid, I grew up in a fairly standard house, nothing out of the ordinary. My father was a naval commander, which makes some sense. But for a time before I got into the world of geopolitics, I was in a touring band and mixing sound and doing events around the country and doing that and being that kind of reckless, you know, young, 18, 20-year-old kid before I got into sort of music writing, and that took me into ghostwriting. So yeah, nothing generally too crazy, I think, out of the ordinary. But yeah, it was a weird path to get into geopolitics, I guess.
I mean, that's pretty exciting. Touring with a band seems a bit out of the ordinary. How'd you end up doing that?
I'd always liked music. Like, I always really liked music. I'd been playing for years. I think I would have been 12, 13, or maybe even 14. All my friends, classic sort of late, mid-2000s, where everyone's in a band and everyone's, I'm not an attractive guy. And if I wanted to attract any girls, then obviously I was going to have to join a band. That's just what you had to do. So I joined a band as a bass player because I wasn't good enough to play guitar, nice. Which is going to offend every bass player ever. I was playing in a hardcore, metal band in various bands for a long time, really enjoyed that, and then started working on, records for my bands and helping other bands and kind of all went from there. But yeah, it was a weird, weird world. There's photos of me when I'm sort of 18 with my long mop-like hair and wearing Parkway Drive shirts and the whole deal, probably out there somewhere still.
Mate, that's absolutely epic. Are you guys still on Spotify, or were you ever?
We are, yeah. I've got a couple of bands on Spotify still. Very long time ago. Although we had our entire play count erased a few years ago, and I forgot to pay the bill, which is a bit annoying.
Oh, fuck. It is. Brutal.
But there are music videos out there and the whole deal. But yeah, it's such an odd sort of path into this one. But yeah, a lot of good stories, a lot of interesting times. Weirdly enough, the singer of that band, my main band I did touring with, is actually in, works for the government over in Australia now. And it's just a weird world that we both really enjoyed touring and playing in bands I guess playing, rock, indie kind of stuff for a very long time.
Is music still a big part of your life?
Not as much these days. I work, unfortunately, about 90, 90-something hours a week at the moment, so there's not much time to do much outside of work these days. But, you know, I still do pick up the guitar occasionally, and, yeah, I still do really do enjoy it and play occasionally. And if a friend says, hey, I need a bass player or a guitar player to fill in for a show or something, I might go do that. But, yeah, I'm nowhere near as as good as I was, and I think I'm a bit, I'm becoming too much of an old man to jump off amps and, you know, all that stuff I used to do back in the day.
That's a pretty epic pivot from the bass player into a geopolitical analyst, but it makes me think of this great quote from Christopher Hitchens, which sort of lives with me. He was asked about his own sort of career and job prospects, etc., when he was a relatively young man, and he said that he's never, ever been interested in a career. Instead, he just wanted to have a life. You know, he wanted it to be interesting. And if I just project onto, you know, your experience, the little of it that I know, but being able to be a part of a band, tour a country, I mean, forget money, forget career ambition, etc. It's like, what a life. And to be able to pivot into what you went into as well. How does that make you feel? That idea of wanting to have a life, not a career.
That's exactly it. Like, that's pretty much smack on the mark. You know, I see friends who have gone into investment banking or have gone into, you know, high-powered government jobs or whatever it is. And then, you know, it seems like a, you know, very kind of boring life. Like, it's interesting. They get to do what they want to do sometimes. And, you know, I don't knock it. You know, if that's what they want to do, that's what they want to do. But, you know, if they were to get hit by a bus by, tomorrow, you know, heaven forbid, what stories they would have to remember, you know, they would have at a party, or what stories they remember at the end, you know, I don't think would be as interesting. It's been a weird thing that sort of from years of doing stuff that, you know, is not the most financially incentivized, but, you know, it definitely gives you a bunch of, you know, interesting stories. And I think the aim is that no matter what, you know, what my child does, I'll always be able to outdo him with a, well, you know, that's cool, but your dad did this.
Has it always been Perth?
I've been based in Perth for, you know, I grew up south of Perth. I've usually always been based out of here, but I've been, you know, it's a really interesting city because it's not too far from everywhere else. I mean, it's far from most places. There's always a nasty flood at the beginning and end of everything, but, you know, it's better to go get to from the east, you know, to the rest of the world. You know, it's not too far from the east coast. It's better time zone for most things. But yeah, it's kind of always had an address somewhere in Perth, I guess. But you know, for a lot of the time I was 6 months on the road, or I would be, you know, out of a year, it wouldn't be unusual that I would have spent nearly 9 months of that on the road. So yeah, I mean, Perth is a, great place to kind of base yourself out of. And I actually had a friend from the UK who was working for the, UK government come over here, and he was sort of transiting through. So took a man around Perth for a couple of days, and yeah, immediately he's like, now considering living here, because it is like, Perth is an amazingly beautiful city. You know, the weather's great, the people are lovely, the you know, cost of living's quite cheap. You know, it's cheaper to fly to Bali than it is to the East Coast, which I think says a lot about our culture, I guess, is Perth. It is the only place I think in the world where there's a bunch of high-vis guys who are also wine snobs. Which is very, very odd. It's, you know, see all these guys in, bright fluorescent band. Oh, no. The Shiraz here is absolutely god-awful. It's a very odd city, but, you know, it's a great place to be based out of, I guess.
So you don't feel limitations being away from Sydney?
Not really. I mean, that's the thing. I think it'd be a bit different if I worked in, you know, Australian foreign policy. And when you do, there is, you know, when you do work for the Australian government, but you're based off here, you are flying back and forth all the time. But these days, if you're working, you know, on Russia or Europe or any of those things, then you can be kind of based anywhere if you're bouncing between, you know, all the time. But no, generally Sydney, I can't stand the traffic. The people aren't quite as nice. I think, you know, it doesn't take alcoholism as a sport like Perth does, which is always nice. it's just a really comfortable place to be. And obviously my partner has got lots of family here and I've got family here, and yeah, again, the weather can't be beaten. Frankly, I don't have to deal with Sydney people, which is always nice as well.
One of the great, great unsung heroes of all the technology that we have available to us, we really can do most jobs from wherever we choose, if you can, you know, make it work for yourself. But you have, by its very, very definition, an extremely international schedule and as well contact base, and you're working with people outside of your own city, yet you can still live there.
Yeah, and it's always interesting though when I have to go to, you know, go to Washington, and I sort of tell, when I get to Washington, I say, you know, I'm almost as far away from home as I can be, because if I was to go into my house and dig right through the ground, I'd come out just near the Bahamas. And it's about a 3.5-hour flight from Washington. So yeah, every time I have to go on back to the States, good God, that's a very long flight. But generally, yeah, it's not too far from, you know, not too far from Central Asia or Southeast Asia or China, and yeah, and it's, at least it's a good time zone, I guess, to work in.
Do you spend much time on the road these days?
I do. I spend. It's been a bit quiet last kind of couple of months because I'm on the project at the moment. But yeah, I'm still on the road quite often. You know, that's why. You know, I guess if you're a keen listener of The Red Line, you'll kind of know some episodes are filmed a bit in advance, others are as they come out. But yeah, it's always sort of interesting to kind of have to be, you know, I'll be in rural Tajikistan and having to record a quick voiceover or a quick, you know, a line of an episode somewhere because it's, okay, well, something changed in this and, okay, this fact wasn't right, so I have to quickly go in and, you know, record a 2 lines in a kitchen somewhere in Tajikistan because it's the only place we can get good Wi-Fi. So yeah, it's always a fun time.
So were you academically inclined as a teenager?
Not as much. You know, I was definitely not an A-level student in high school. Again, because I was going to be a musician, man. I was going to be a rock star, and you don't need grades for that. But I did later on go on to do a degree in international relations and economics. So I guess I kind of crushed those rock star dreams pretty quick when that first supply and demand graph came in. But yeah, no, it's, you know, academic is really, it's an interesting world. And I guess the weird bit is going from, you know, you come out of high school and you have this kind of way of writing, and if you're writing for a magazine at the time and you learn how to write, you know, for a very generalized audience, you're writing to a much younger audience, you go into academia, and then you got to write for an academic audience. And then when you get out of academia, you realize that you actually have to go back to writing for a very generalized audience. Particularly, you know, it's very weird if you're briefing congressmen or you're briefing, you know, CEOs, quite often you have to bring it right back down to a really basic level and give people analogies and make jokes and kind of explain things in a way that people can grip around if they know nothing about the subject. So it's a very weird, you know, particularly coming off, you know, where I'll write a really, you know, detailed report about, you know, economic movements of you know, tank production within the Russian system. And then I'll go off and do a Red Line episode where it's, hey, let's take this concept and then make it somehow understandable to a general audience without having to, you know, make some joke or an analogy or you know, pitch it around some weird story so that people kind of get that, you know, get the understanding of it without me having to sit there and become an Excel spreadsheet for 20 minutes. So yeah, in long way around with the question, I guess, but yeah, academia, it's interesting, but I think it's a little more interesting to sit on the other side of it.
But I'm just thinking, you know, did you have these sort of latent interest in trying to make sense for how the world works? As you're touring with the band, you know, in your downtime, you're maybe consuming an audiobook, listening to a podcast, or trying to have some type of interesting... Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, because it is, you know, if you understand how the world works, you get, it's, you know, it's the closest you'll ever get to having a crystal ball. You know, if you understand the economics of things, you understand how, you know, one thing is going to affect another. It gives you this ability to, you know, anticipate what is going to come up in the world. And that is hugely, hugely important.
And it's also just inherently interesting.
It is. I remember, you know, a couple of days ago talking with a colleague of mine who was sort of asking, oh, why is, you know, Emmanuel Macron in Kazakhstan? And I said to him, oh, well, obviously it's because of Niger. And it's like, oh, well, what do you mean? It's like, well, Niger had a coup a little while ago, and now the uranium deals are a bit up in the air, and Total's done this, and that affects Algeria. And now, because Algeria is this way, now Macron has to go off to Kazakhstan to see if he can secure uranium. And it just kind of shows how, you know, as much as you can specialize in one area or you can focus on a bit of geopolitics, you have to kind of, you can watch one thing happen and know that down the line, you know, how it's going to affect something else down there. Yeah, and it is interesting that you, if you kind of, even if you just have a basics of, and I don't think I know everything about everything, but if you, even if you have the basics or you surround yourself with people who are quite clever on certain subjects, you can sort of pick what's going to happen, you know, most of the time ahead of time, so which is always nice.
All right, so this serendipitous moment that sort of, looking back at least, appears to be a fork in the road. You and your mate go on a trip to Russia, and then you meet this... Yep. Ghostwriter, conflict journalist in a bar.
Yeah, well, that was a bit later on. So I went to Russia with a, you know, I got very, very drunk with a good, very good friend of mine, and we bought tickets to Russia, to which was probably not the smartest idea, but, you know, whatever. So we decided that, you know, when we woke up a little bit worse for wear, we would go to Russia, and we did. I had a fantastic time and really enjoyed traveling that part of the world. And then I went for a couple of other trips, and I think it was the trip after that, or two trips in that region after that, that I bumped into a ghostwriter in Romania, who had just come out of Russia as well. And yeah, we ended up kind of teaming up, and, you know, he was really good at, he'd already very much embedded in the industry, was really big writing for other people. But yeah, it was, he had the ability to kind of put data together and, you know, understand the economics and what drives the things, but just couldn't, you know, write it for a general audience. And that's where, you know, my speciality was the opposite side of that. So yeah, working together was a bit of a fork in the road, but yeah, it was trying to give, you know, make it more understandable. You know, this is the thing I find with way too many academic papers that, you know, are amazingly, amazingly written. This just, you know, the amount of data we have available to us in today's day and age is just incredible. But when I read most of the papers that I'm forced to read all day, it's a slog. and I won't, you know, I'm not going to throw any names under the bus, but, you know, it is a, just once you wish someone would kind of put an analogy in there or would just, you know, do things like put a yardstick in. And I remember having a chat with one of our new writers a little while ago going, you know, it's tiny little things that you don't think about until you do think about them. And a classic, my classic kind of go-to is, you know, if I say Turkmenistan is a dictatorship, everyone goes, well, yeah, it's a dictatorship, whatever. Yeah, I get it. But if I go, you know, Turkmenistan is lower than North Korea on the freedom scale, people go, holy mother of God. Okay, that is a dictatorship. And it's that, it's little things like that of just giving people, you know, writing it a little bit differently with telling the exact same facts, but then you get a completely different understanding of what the issue is. Yeah, and that's effectively what I've been trying to work on for years and years and years, is trying to break down some of these really odd, complex, weird geopolitical issues down to a more, not dumbed down isn't the right word, but just make it more digestible, I guess.
That's an insane statistic. How can it be the case that there is a country that has a lower freedom index than North Korea?
There is, I think there's about three. No, there's two, sorry. It's South Sudan and Turkmenistan are the two that are lower. South Sudan is a whole other thing, but Turkmenistan is genuinely a more crazy dictatorship than North Korea. I can tell you stories for days about that country.
Yeah, tell us.
So, wow, Turkmenistan is a country where effectively they had a guy who came in right after the Soviet collapse named Niyazov, who, you know, decided that he wanted to be effectively a god emperor. And he gave himself the name of Turkmenbashi, which effectively is like father of the Turkmen. And he wrote this book called the Rokhnama, which is this little pink book. And it got to the point in the country where when you went for your driving test, you wouldn't, you know, do you turn left or right at a stop sign? It would be, when Turkmenbashi went to the lake, how many stones he throw in the lakes? You know, we are at a, effectively, the, it's a very weird situation at the moment, because the father, who has been in for quite a long time, since 06, Berdi Muhammedov, he has just handed to his son, but his son has kind of had a lot of power right back to the father. But Berdi Muhammedov used to do lots of weird things. Like, as a musician, nothing makes me laugh more than he'll play guitar on an acoustic guitar, and as the smoke rises up from the floor, right before the guitar solo, it gets to just about his nipple height where you can't see his hands move. And all of a sudden the music will change to this like shredding electric guitar, but you can't see his hands play, but he's definitely playing it.
Hectic.
Or the annual, you know, they run up the hill from Ashgabat right to the sort of top of the hill. And every year he pretty much wins it. But weirdly enough, he ducks off from the race and his helicopter's up there as well. It's just weird things like that that just make Turkmenistan weird place it is. Yeah, it is.
It's a pure, you know, cult of personality.
There's horrifying, you know, other bits of it as well. But yeah, it's a, you know, a city of marble run by a man who views himself as a pretty much a living god.
Jesus. Give us the geopolitical scorecard for this country. You know, what's their economy? What's their population? Where are they in the world?
So in the world, they'd be north of Iran, you know, between Iran, Afghanistan, you know, a little bit of the west of Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan. It's got quite a small population, depending on if you want to go on the official, you know, numbers or whether you want to go over the real numbers, which is even smaller. It is a gas giant, though. So this is a nation that effectively has, you know, a population of, depending on who you ask, you know, somewhere between 2 and 4 million, but has the same amount of gas as Qatar sitting in the ground. But because of geopolitics and a few other bits and pieces, and the fact that they can't really export much through Iran or Afghanistan because no one really wants to build a big pipe through Afghanistan or anything that explodes at the moment, they pretty much put everything they have toward, you know, Russia or China, which China at one point had bought like 90 or 86% of their exports because it's all just natural gas. So you have this very closed off society where, you know, the little oddities like the fact that they're, you know, Ashgabat Airport is as big as Tel Aviv. It's a massive airport. But because of how difficult it is to get tourist visas, they only see, you know, it's saying like 60,000 tourists a year, which like that's what Heathrow will go through in like an hour and a bit. And that's what they see a year. But it's this airport that's massive. It's that kind of a country where the, you know, the government is so, you know, entrenched in what it wants to do. It hasn't, you know, very much helped its people in a very long time. And they are going through a crisis at the moment where, you know, things like they're worried about people leaving the country. So they've just lobbied Turkey to get rid of the visa-free travel because too many people were leaving. They made it so your passport, once it expires, you can only get renewed back in Turkmenistan. So Turkmens have to come back to Turkmenistan to get their passports renewed.
Right.
Yeah, it is a very, very odd country who has, weirdly enough, a pretty decent military in a lot of ways. you know, lots of higher tech stuff. They're very, very good at, you know, probably, you know, as much as they can't invade anyone very well, what they can do really well is isolate, cut off, and break apart protests incredibly well. And they're very, very, very good at it.
Right.
You know, if there's a city that will have an uprising, you will find, you know, police, armored vehicles, everything there really quickly. It is just an odd country and it is completely locked down. Like they shut the internet off all the time. You know, very, very difficult to get info in and out of the place. If you want to go there, you're pretty much going to have a minder or every room will be bugged. I know there's like as another bit of a weird Turkmen information, you know, the truckers quite often used to drive from Iran into Uzbekistan, but that means you cut across the kind of center of Turkmenistan. And if everybody says it's a, you know, about 12-hour or 13-hour journey or whatever it was, they were having too many truckers who were crashing because, you know, the truckers would get their passport stamped at one end of the Turkmenistan and have to race to the other side because they would only be given like an hour leeway either side before they had to be at the other side. Otherwise, they'd be arrested when they got there because they did not allow these truckers to stop. What that meant, though, was that there was this massive market for meth at either end of the Turkmen border. So the truck drivers could all so take funny. It and go. You know, it's been a massive news in Turkmenistan that they're now allowing the truckers to stop at this one town in the middle, stay at this one hotel, and they can sleep there the night and then continue on in the morning. But the hotel is very much watched and the truckers can't leave to go, you know, mingle with the locals or anything like that. But it's that kind of a country where, you know, things that would be unfathomable anywhere else is just day-to-day news in Turkmenistan. Yeah.
Show me the incentive and I'll show you the outcome. You force that totally arbitrary time window. All of a sudden, meth's the only way to get across it. It's absolutely wild. I can't believe... I really have never wouldn't have been able to tell you where it was on a map, know absolutely nothing about the country. Are they significant in terms of who they're supplying their gas to? Do they have a lot of sanctions imposed on them?
No, almost no sanctions imposed upon them. This is the weird thing. Obviously, we look at, you know, all these dictatorships around the world and, you know, sanctions and anti-US and the rest of Turkmenistan has kind of just flown under everybody's radar because they are, in part of their constitution, in part of their entire national doctrine is to be as neutral as possible. They don't join, you know, as much as particularly the Turkmen security services have a lot of connections and ties with Russia and you know, Russian heads of state and are very close with sort of the ruling clans in Turkmenistan. The Turkmen government does not join official alliances, and it's not genuinely a threat to anyone. You know, the Iranians don't view it as a giant threat. Afghanistan, you know, the Turkmen have been happy to work with the United States to effectively help them do some refueling and logistic stuff, you know, back when the war on terror was really kicking around. You know, Uzbekistan kind of views them as a, well, you know, it's a close-off country. They're not really a threat. It's just a bunch of gas. So, yeah, they've kind of gone under everyone's radar, which is really odd considering the human rights record in the country.
Yeah, that's totally wild. Is the explanation that it's just a blind spot?
Yeah,
or
pretty much.
Or because maybe... Yeah, okay.
It's pretty much just because they don't raise any trouble. You know, you don't have... You know, with a North Korea, they are very loud, they're boisterous, and that's part of their foreign policy. You know, they are... You know, it's no shock to anyone who watches North Korea that they're about to arc up because they know they always did this every election cycle. But with Turkmenistan, they don't say peekaboo. They just don't say anything. They don't bother anyone. And it's very much a just leave us alone and we'll just keep sending gas everyone else's way. And that's what's kept them effectively where they are at the moment, which is really interesting as a sort of difference in policy between themselves and Pyongyang. But yeah, generally, you know, a lot of these countries in Central Asia were pretty harsh dictatorships. Tajikistan still wears quite low. We're talking, you know, on the Freedom House's freedom scale, you know, Turkmenistan's a 2 out of 100. Tajikistan's a 7. Uzbekistan's, I think, growing. They're about a 18 at the moment. They're getting better. Kazakhstan's in the mid-30s and Kyrgyzstan's falling very quickly. But that's a whole other story. Yeah, whereas, you know, the United States, maybe. That's going to be like 82. You're Sweden, you know, Sweden where you are. If I'm right, it's a 96 or it's 100 out of 100. I know you guys tend to be right near the top. So, yeah, it's an interesting dichotomy between looking at Sweden and then looking at Turkmenistan again.
Remind me if we don't get to it later, but I'd love to hear you talk about Kyrgyzstan as well. But I think what you just, mate, like basically what you just said was a fascinating sliver into sort of what you can expect fortnightly from the Red Line. But return us to the timeline. So you're doing these tours for pleasure into Russia. I'm missing the piece for how you transition from a bassist to a journalist.
So I was already at that point when I was touring, I was writing as a music journalist, interviewing bands and writing about festivals and records and artists. You know, it was just something I kind of fell into because I was, you know, in the touring scene. I kind of got what was going on. I could write. You know, if you're an editor and you have a writer who is also able to use the equipment and take photos and record interviews and has, you know, a bit of an audio background, it just makes things a lot easier. So, you know, I think I got a lot of jobs in those early days because it's like, well, if we send Michael to go interview this band, then he can set up his own equipment, which is always nice. I was a music writer for a long time when I was touring and doing everything else. And, you know, obviously that taught me how to do a bit of writing and how to write in that style. And that's kind of what, you know, wasn't a big shift to go from, actually it wasn't as big a shift as people probably think it would be to go from music journalism to geopolitical stuff because, frankly, there's just as much gossiping. Actually, I think quite often musicians are better behaved than the diplomats. I'll give you that.
Oh, that's hilarious, right? All right. So what's the first genuinely geopolitical analyst versus, you know, non-musical reporting? What's the first piece that you did or you were contracted to do?
Most of them I won't be able to actually say because as I said, I was ghostwriting at the time. So, it's not you sign massive of contracts saying that you can't say anything, which makes things complicated. Trying to think, my first public piece.
Maybe how old were you when you first doing the ghostwriting stuff on behalf of diplomats?
I would have been about 23, 24. Maybe, yeah, around 23, 24.
I mean, this is extremely exciting, right?
Kind of. Again, it's odd when you look back at it all, you know, kind of laid out the way we're doing it at the moment. But at the time, it just feels like it's, you know, oh, okay, that seems interesting. Let's give that a shot. You know, it is very odd to say, but it is, you know, at the time it was just something I thought, let's give it a shot and see how it goes. I mean, that's how, you know, the Red Line, it's how a lot of this stuff has been. It's been a, well, that seems like an interesting project. Let's go for it. But yeah, at the time, I don't think I realized the significance of it at the time, I guess.
And so, for instance, some UK defense minister will hire you or fellow ghostwriters like you to compile a report that they can then slap their name on and say, look what I did here, and it gives them more authority in the home country.
Yes. So if you're particularly a minister who wants to go for the role, you know, and isn't, you know, big on that role, you will write, you know, you'll pay someone else to write that for you. Or, you know, when you're the actual minister, you can get, you know, lots of guys from the Department of Defense and all sorts of stuff to help you write that. But at this early stage, particularly if you're, you know, maybe even a candidate trying to go for it as well, it's always good to kind of have defense chops, you know, and have a good opinion on some of these things, can put yourself out as a serious candidate. So, yeah, there is, you'll find, particularly in the United States as well, it's like most campaigns will effectively hire defense writers and foreign policy writers, even if they're really small candidates, because they need to have a, you know, when they get asked on, you know, on the, you know, campaign trail, hey, you know, what do you think about our India policy, or what do you think about our Saudi Arabia policy? They need to come up with a proper line, because if they, you know, when they don't, you end up with Gary Johnson saying, you know, what's a, you know, what's an Aleppo, or what's a, you know, I can't remember what a line was years ago, but yeah, and, you know, it's, if you get it wrong, it is something that will absolutely get pounded at you for the next few months. Yet if you get it right, most people won't even think about it. It's a very, very odd world.
And how big is the world? How big is the industry of ghostwriters doing the work you were doing?
Huge. Yeah, there's quite a lot. A lot of the time, because ministers are, you know, some of them are because they're just too busy. You know, they don't, you know, no minister or CEO wants to spend, you know, 20 hours going through like some of the most boring reports you've ever read in your entire life, whether it be diplomatic cables or whether it be export reports or whatever it is. So they'll just pay someone else to do that and give them the summary, which is very common as well. Ghostwriting, you know, if that's quite common for anyone who's trying to be in politics or is trying to write a book or even just wants to kind of add bits and pieces to their current report, quite often it's, you know, you'll also get hired to write sections of bigger reports as well, is quite common. So let's say someone's writing a business case for, you know, starting a copper mine in, you know, Kazakhstan, for sake of the argument. You know, you'll probably go and write this big business case, and you'll make sure there's a couple of foreign policy guys in there to go, hey, here's what Kazakhstan's going to do if you do that, but also here's the kind of the risk points in the region you'd have to worry about at that point. And this is how you should build it into your business case. So yeah, sometimes it's like you are, you know, you read their stuff and you're just making small tweaks. And other times it's, oh my God, none of this is going to work. You have to pretty much start from scratch. And other times you're writing very large pieces. You know, it really just depends on what is on your docket that week. I think that's the weird bit of it, that it's different for every person and every industry, I guess.
Mate, it sounds like the most incredible education into how does the world work. If you're just thinking of an occupation, I mean, get paid to learn all this stuff. I mean, forget the ego of needing to attach your name to it, but you're getting the resources to answer these interesting questions that are inherently interesting to you anyway, and forcing yourself to write them down on paper so you can actually understand them. I mean, maybe I'm just over-projecting here, but it does sound like a phenomenal way to spend your time.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good job if you really are interested in the subject matter. And that's the difference. You know, it is, I think if you had a passing fancy in geopolitics, I think you'd be really bored by reading, you know, diplomatic cables or transcripts or sitting through horrifyingly boring speeches by politicians because you know there's two lines in there that will actually outline their policy going forward. So I think anyone who works in this industry, and whether it be on the Red Line or anyone I work professionally or anything like that, they always tend to have an earphone in one ear at all times because you're just always listening to some terrible book that is badly voiced over, or it's a text-to-speech program reading a terrifyingly boring report, or some awful politician speech. I think, I have an ear, like a headphone in my ear pretty much all the time. So it's always my wife pretty much at this point, just if she sees me and needs to talk to me, she just pretty much, taps the pause button on my ear, and that's the only way to really get a hold of me these days.
So right now, some of my fellow Swedish comrades, will be, for instance, ghostwriting reports on the implications of joining NATO from X, Y, and Z perspectives.
Yep.
That's an example.
Yeah. So that will be absolutely. So you'll have lots of people who will either be, doing it for, magazines. A lot of companies will be also right now starting business cases, because obviously when you join NATO as a as a country, quite often, particularly with Sweden, who is going to be very much, it's not as big a deal with Montenegro joining, or some one of those really small countries. But with Sweden, there's so much infrastructure, there's so much going into this. And Sweden is such it completely changes the defense dynamic of the Baltics. It is chalk and cheese between, reading, how defense plans will be written pre and post Sweden. And effectively, NATO is going to put a lot of money in whether it be to sort of help communication lines, effectively help logistics happen better out of Sweden, prepare for better defensiveness of Sweden. I know Sweden's reactivating a lot of their bases in Gotland, which is a big deal for you guys. But it'll also be a case of a lot of businesses now in Sweden will be, whether you make steel, whether you make helmets, whether you do catering, whether you do anything of that kind of variety, you're probably going to be at this point thinking, how can I cash in on the NATO gravy train, or how can I be a part of this, massive investment that'll be coming into Sweden at the moment? So everyone in Sweden, in Swedish industry, will be effectively preparing at the moment for this.
Yeah.
Or probably already has at this point.
Absolutely amazing. And I imagine, obviously, it must differ depending on the project you're undertaking, how long it takes, etc. But typically, how much would you expect to get paid? Whether you want to speak from personal experience or just as generally in the industry?
It would completely depend on, it's completely different from job to job. And also how much you charge and what you want to do. And it depends how long it's going to take. Some projects are, a 6-month job, and others are like, hey, can you just read this, read this 3-page, case or study or whatever it is, and just tell me that I'm on the right track. You get paid it's so varied. It will change completely differently compared to what you're doing.
And would a ghostwriter be sought out because of their pre-existing political slant? Or is the idea here typically that you just want objective down the line observation? Or are there also people looking for... Yeah, go on.
This is a fascinating question. I'm really glad you asked it. So there are three, effectively kind of three types you can go. So some people will hire, a really objective writer or a really objective firm to go look into this. And quite often that firm or that original sort of investigation, you actually do hire someone who's really good at what they do. That person you hire will almost a good chunk of the time not actually end up being the person that writes the final report. Now, that'll be effectively for the shareholders, for the CEOs, for people to look at and go, okay, to start up this copper mine or to build this, new factory in Romania or whatever it is, that's how much it's going to cost. And this is the risk, and this is what we have to worry about. And then you can hire other firms. Now, there are obviously think tanks you can get to do this as well. Some have complete political slants and leanings. If you want to get a really conservative answer, you go hire someone like the Heritage Foundation. And if you want to go hire someone for a complete, left-leaning answer, you'd hire someone like the Australia Institute in Australia. You hire those guys because you want a certain outcome. And then you obviously get the really, really hacky guys, and I probably won't throw them under the bus to be polite, but who will come in and their first question as a consultant will be, what are you hoping the answer for this question will be? And you will say to them, oh, well, we're hoping that the case is good and that we, you know, we should start this operation in Romania. And they'll go, fantastic, give us 2 months. And they'll give you back a report that suggests that that should be the way forward. So yeah, you often have a complete report written that will be for the shareholders and for your internal use. So you actually know how much it's going to cost. And then you have a report that you release to the public. It's a very odd world.
And that report, which just confirms the outcome you already want, this is the one you ship around to the finances and the investors to actually get your copper mine prospecting off the ground or something like that.
Absolutely. So if you think there's a, you know, 50-50 chance you make money, because that's what the real report says, you'll make sure that the, you know, the one that you have publicly commissioned will be, say there's an 80-90% chance you'll make money. Because that way you have more chance of getting capital coming in and more chance of other smaller companies buying in, and people aren't going to charge you as much interest on your loans, and there's a whole bunch of other things that come with it. But yeah, it's very odd that there is this kind of entire industry of people built into creating reports to match what people want the reports to say.
Such a fascinating world, eh? I mean, are these mostly academics, or are they even, say, like undergrads who don't even have the qualifications, but are nonetheless equally talented and deeply interesting, who are doing this sort of stuff? Or is it tenured professors who no one knows their name outside of their extremely narrow niche, but nonetheless have just supreme expertise, and this is actually how they're, you know, paying for the car upgrade?
Yeah. So the, again, if we talk about the sort of the two contrasting kind of reports you want written, if you're going for the real report, quite often it'll be a combination of some finance guys, some tenured, some professors is probably not the right word, they don't do too much of this, but it'll be experts who quite often used to work intelligence. This whole industry is so full of spooks. Defense guys are quite often in it. That kind of industry is who you get to, and journalists are also quite common as well. Mostly it's a lot of things in that first report where it's you'll be hiring someone because of their connections, and you know, if we were to start a mine here, which crime organizations would we have to bribe to make sure the trucks get there on time? You know, that's the sort of things you would hire for that initial report. When it comes to the sort of the, hey, what do you want this report to say, guys? It is a combination of overworked undergrads and coked up sales managers. like a lot of those, you know, particularly some of the bigger consultancy firms are all just like lads who went to school with the CEO's son. You know, it's a absolute ragtag full of guys. There's some very, very smart people in there behind the scenes. But yeah, it's the guys that you usually have the meetings with in the boardroom are some of the weirdest, oddest people you'll deal with. They're very, very boisterous, and they've got more money than they ever know what to do with. And they will go back to that poor intern who has a master's in economics and will say, you know, hey, here's the Excel spreadsheet, make it say 22% profit, and I'll see you in 3 weeks.
I'm having this real visceral moment right now. Occasionally, you know, you get to actually peek under the hood into the mechanics of how a certain gear and lever within the economy and how the world works. It feels like this is really just unknown. Unless you're in it, you'd be completely ignorant to the fact that these people are operating.
Well, I mean, yeah, it's who would really think about it? And the whole industry relies on that not being the case. Even some of the really big, big players in it, like, you know, guys like McKinsey, who's probably the most famous kind of business consultants, they don't even put signage on their building in New York, their main headquarters, because it is kind of if you're in the industry, everyone knows who McKinsey is. If you are not in the industry, no one really thinks about McKinsey very much, even though they constantly advise presidents, and it's a whole thing.
Totally. Yeah, I interviewed... I interviewed, shit, what's his name? He wrote When McKinsey Comes to Town.
Yes.
Yeah, Pulitzer Prize winner.
Yeah, I remember reading about half of it. It was just in some of my excerpts for something I was reading. Yeah, again, it's a fascinating world under the hood. And again, there's a whole other world of private intelligence and then private militaries. And, you know, it's a...
Wow.
You know, we are entering this really weird age where, you know, you'd always kind of think, hey, a nation state is, you know, like countries are the big sort of power players in here. But then we start to think about, okay, who's more powerful, Google or the African nation of Benin? Well, obviously, Google's more powerful. And then you think, so does Google have a military? Does Disney have a military? You know, actually, yes. These days, these guys have entire armies of consultants and private security and international intelligence guys. And also, you know, it's a... So many of these organizations are being sort of doubled up, even as consultants and a few other things. And there's a whole other world on top of that of... I guess the over-vetting is a really odd problem that's unique to Western intelligence as well. You know, I can go down that rabbit hole rabbit hole if you want, but yeah. Again, it's a weird world.
Nice. And so, just from your own experiences, you were doing this freelance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Correct?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. And finally, just on this line of questioning... Presumably, people listening to this will find it as fascinating as I do and would be thinking to themselves, how could I somehow insert myself into this world? I don't want to offer you a too sappy of a question, like how can someone do it? But that also is kind of what I'm asking.
I honestly don't know. That's the weird bit. It is mostly about who you know. It is mostly about making friends within that weird circle. I mean, there's far easier ways to get into it. Obviously, you know, it's pretty much a pipeline that the moment you join, let's say, an intelligence agency of one of the major nations, the moment you either leave or you get headhunted whilst you're there, you'll leave that directly into, you know, being offered jobs with one of these intelligence firms. If you have worked at one management consulting company, you're kind of in that circle and people tend to know everyone in that circle. But a lot of it is... You know, if you work in the consultancy world or you work in the sort of freelance world, you end up, if you're good at your job, you end up making a lot of contacts. And you end up, if you're good at your job, making a lot of helpful relationships. You know, it'll be things like,
right.
You know, I will happily help friends when they call me and say, hey, you know, I'm stuck on a problem. I can't find, you know, anyone who has any data on this particular, Tajik air, you know, Tajik military base. No one has any data. I go, I have the data on that, no problem. Here's the data you need. But when I call them in 3 months and say, hey, you know, I need a, you know, colonel or higher from the Russian military who would be aware of this particular fact. And they go, no problem, I'll get that sorted for you. You know, it is a, you end up making a lot of weird contacts and a lot of weird friends, and it is a very, that's the kind of industry it is. It again, it's very, very weird. And my my phone number, the phone numbers and plus digits that sort of ring me through the day and the night are always completely odd. So it's always fun to wake up in the middle of the night to a plus, you know. It can be any sort of number and go, perfectly reasonable. Who is this? You know, no problem. We'll figure it out when I answer the phone.
Yeah, totally. All right, so you're 23, 24. You've transitioned into this ghostwriting new world of opportunity. Mm-hmm. When does the red line start to conceptualize in your head?
Again, it was, I didn't think it was going to be anything. It was more I'd kind of wanted to do something a bit more creative. I had a bit more time on my hands, and I thought, you know, let's, you know, a few friends had kind of said to me, we should do a you know, you should do a podcast or something like that. I went, yeah, you know, give it a shot. And I was going to do it with another journalist here in WA, in Western Australia. But it was going to be on Australian politics. And we got the show going. And I sent a tape of the first episode off to a couple of producers I knew who immediately told me, hey, jokes or genocide, don't do both. So I had to kind of, redo the seriousness of the show. So it wasn't, you know, because I'm, you know, this is what kind of, it's a bit odd because in the show I'm very serious from almost all of it. Whereas I think in real life I'm a lot more relaxed about most things. And then we kind of did the first episode, which was Afghanistan, and was meant to be our international one. We pivot back to Australian politics. We talk about West Papua, which is kind of very close to Australia. It's part of Australian foreign policy.
Yeah.
You know, housing crisis, I think, was our third. And that was, yeah, it did okay. And then we did Yemen and the, you know, like the other, you know, the show was going to pivot. The other journalists were like, no, I'm going to go do something else. I went, yeah, okay, I'll do the red line because, you know, I'll see where it goes. And it kind of took off a little bit from there. And, you know, it's been going bigger and bigger and bigger ever since. And now we've got a big team and lots of people. And yeah, pretty shocked with where it's at the moment.
Millions of monthly downloads, correct?
Yeah, about 2 million a month, which is always...
Mate.
Always absolutely
phenomenal. Yeah. Which puts you right at the tail end of the podcast distribution, which is... It would make you one of Australia's biggest podcasts, surely.
Yeah, I think we'd be in the top, you know, point something percent. But yeah, like it's still just boggles my mind that people listen and tune in every week. Yeah. So, again, chuffed about it.
Well, congratulations, man.
Again,
but I wouldn't congratulate. It's fucking quality.
Oh, well, thank you very much. But again, it's not just me. I know it sounds, you know, like it's my voice on the show and everything, but it's, you know, the only reason this thing works and the way it works now, and the comment we get most often is that the show is very well researched. And that's because we have this massive research team pulling together just crazy amounts of work and time. And they're like, I cannot, you know, stress how reliant I am on my team. And it is, you know, I keep telling them that it's weird that, you know, you'll get government briefings and your government reports, and then you get what the Red Line guys give you. And I can honestly say the Red Line briefings are usually better. Some of the older staff have also like completely worked out how to write. So they know, they even know which bits that are underlined. They're like, Michael is 100% going to want to know that fun fact, and it'll be right there, ready to go and everything. Yeah. So yeah, like when we put an episode together, it's not unusual that when I go, you know, the team has gone away, done their research, come back, and I've done my kind of preliminary research to see, get my head around it before I go into the first meeting with them. And they'll hand me like a 50, 60 page packet of like everything with links and extra bits and yeah, just have to go through that, and that kind of forms the basis of the episode. So yeah, as much as it's, you know, it sounds like it's my show, it's very much, we've only got to where we are because we have this amazing team behind it.
And what year did you settle on the format? Like when it really became the Red Line, 3 guests, fortnightly publication?
Pretty much from episode one. This is what the format's been from the first episode. We originally were going to do...
What year was that?
2019. It'd be October 2019.
Cool.
So we were originally going to do all the guests at the same time. And then I tried to book an episode like that and then realized it's almost impossible to get guests in any time slot, let alone try and get a few on at the same time. Yeah, this is the crazy bit. Like, obviously, we have guests from lots of different time zones and all over the place. So my diary is just an absolute nightmare of different time zones to deal with all the time. But, you know, for guests, it makes it a bit more flexible because I can, you know, have one at 2 a.m. and one at 3 a.m. and one at midday and kind of go from there. But yeah, trying to get them all on a single panel, I have PTSD nightmares just thinking about trying to book those again. But yeah, that, so the format has been pretty consistent the whole time. And that's, yeah, you know, because whole format we wanted, which was all, you know, to get a few different points of opinion in on a certain subject.
Mm. And the Red Line as a business, because you do produce more than the show, is that correct?
Well, kind of like we do. So the Red Line does just the Red Line. And then, you know, obviously we do consulting and a few bits and pieces as well. You know, people quite often hire us for research, which is, as I said, fantastic researchers. Yeah. And then obviously Red Line we have this new sister show called Context Matters. We're doing with the guys over at Economics Explained. And then we've got, you know, I also do lots of consulting work on the side, but Red Line's never been, you know, a big profit generator. Obviously the consulting stuff does, but the show, for us, you know, we're not selling we're not selling Enyo mitts and black powder coffee or anything like that. So, you know, it makes it definitely limits your revenue streams, I guess. But, you know, it's always been
you're not selling AG1?
Oh, not yet. You know, there's something. If I do it, it'll be fantastic. I mean, you know, this Somalia is running out of food and there's an embargo, but you don't have to be embargoed thanks to HelloFresh, and then we'll just bang into it. That's the plan.
Oh my goodness.
That would be an absolutely perfect transition.
That's closer to the original format.
Yeah, probably totally would be.
Absolutely seamless transition.
You know, it is an odd thing. You know, I speak to, you know, other creators who are kind of in this field doing this, and it's always an interesting kind of, I think the ones who are the long-term success and the ones who do, you know, really well at this for, you know, quite a long period of time are the ones who aren't as financially driven by it. And this is the thing, you know, I've had sit downs with guys from YouTube and a few other places who will tell you straight up and go, look, if you're willing to go more bombastic and partisan, lots more money. But obviously, you know, that would be you do that, congrats, lots of money. But at the same time, you also end up selling your soul is not the right word, but you just, you know, I don't think the rest of the industry will take you credibly after that. Plus, if you keep it in a format where you enjoy what you do and it's still, you know, it doesn't feel, you know, it's interesting to sort of think about, but I this is why I don't talk about myself. I feel I could walk away from it at any point. It doesn't feel like my house doesn't rely on the Red Line doing what it does, which is takes a little bit of pressure off and still keeps it as an interesting, fun project for me, I guess. Most of our Patreon goes towards effectively keeping, you know, the lights on, keeping staff and lawyers and everything else we need on retainer, because good God, there's some episodes you don't need anything, but others, my God, you have to get people to look over every line you're about to say. Particularly anything with a mining company, good God, we've got to go get everything double checked.
Economics Explained, that's such a fun partner to be working with. And as well, another great Australian content creator.
Yes. It is really, yeah, crazy how that whole thing came along. I won't say too much about it, because obviously he's pretty closed about how he does his stuff and his process and everything else. And I'm not going to dox him, and I'm not going to, you know, out him for anything. Pretty much will keep everything to what we do. I think I'm a bit more open about how Redline runs and how he does his stuff. But yeah, it's been a really interesting partnership to kind of see how the two of us work. Completely different styles. Which is always really interesting, because I've been a fan of his channel for a very long time. You know, he also does that thing I love, where it's like taking a really difficult concept and kind of breaking it right down and making it much more digestible. So yeah, it just seemed like a really good partnership and a really good kind of collaboration to work on this extra channel. So it's been interesting to kind of having that going, and then Redline as well, and, you know, having this two very different styles of content, I guess.
Congrats, man. That's amazing, because he totally gets how to, whether it's from a production standpoint or the script or whatever it is, but the success of his channel and YouTube alone is just to have watched it from afar. Because I remember, I think he started posting in 2019-ish, similar. It was just before COVID. I remember watching one of his first videos about the, was it the Australian guy who made billions on Hong Kong racing or something like that? And just since then, you know, he's taking these economic lessons that I would have done at university, put really, really good narrative behind it, good graphics, and I think he's millions of subscribers at this point on YouTube, right?
Yeah, what is he up to these days? He's at 2.5 million subscribers, which is huge.
I mean, what a beast.
He deserves every bit of it. Amazing. Like, he works really hard. Does a lot of a lot of work on these ones. And again, great guy, great program, very happy to be working with him.
All right, mate. So in the time we have left, I just would love to have you open up a little bit like you did earlier with Turkmenistan. But from an Australian perspective, so Indonesia, Papua New Guinea, these are super critical, maybe Papua New Guinea less, but Indonesia specifically, so critical to Australia's geopolitics. Mm-hmm. yet I feel personally, maybe I'm a representation of the rest of Australia, I just don't know really anything about the country, why it matters, etc. So from an Australian perspective, could you please explain Indonesia's geopolitics?
Okay, so Indonesia is
incredible. Okay, so just before Michael gets into the geopolitical significance of Indonesia for Australians, and then a little bit more, serendipity in his own life and his answer to a country is most bullish on, he takes us on a tour around the globe. It's really, really good. Hit the top link in the description, and it'll take you directly to the Curious World Food podcast feed where you'll be able to finish this episode. So do it, pump your juice, and see you soon.